played at the IMG Academy in Florida.
I hate these kinds of bets, said Maury.
He'd watched Singh work out for 30 minutes, but his decision was already made. They had no data on him. Without data, there's nothing to analyze. The Indian was DeAndre Jordan all over again. He was like most of the problems you faced in life, a puzzle with pieces missing. The Houston Rockets would pass on him and be shocked when the Dallas Mavericks took him in the second round of the NBA draft. Then again, you never knew. And that was the problem. You never knew. In Maury's 10 years of using his statistical model with the Houston Rockets, the players he drafted, after accounting for the draft slot in which they'd been taken, had performed better than the players drafted by three-quarters of the other NBA teams. His approach had been sufficiently effective that other NBA teams were adopting it. He could even pinpoint the moment when he felt, for the first time, imitated. It was during the 2012 draft when the players were picked in almost the exact same order the Rockets ranked them. It's going straight down our list, said Maury. The league was seeing things the same way. And yet, even Leslie Alexander, the only owner with both the inclination and the nerve to hire someone like him back in 2006, could grow frustrated with Daryl Morey's probabilistic view of the world. He will want certainty from me, and I have to tell him it ain't coming, said Maury. He'd set out to be a card counter at a casino blackjack table, but he could live the analogy only up to a point. Like a card counter, he was playing a game of chance. Like a card counter, he'd tilted the odds of that game slightly in his favor. Unlike a card counter, but a lot like someone making a life decision, he was allowed to play only a few hands. He drafted a few players a year. In a few hands, anything could happen, even with the odds in his favor. At times, Maury stopped to consider the forces that had made it possible for him, a total outsider who could offer his employer only slightly better odds of success to run a professional basketball team. He hadn't needed to get rich enough to buy one. Oddly enough, he hadn't needed to change anything about himself. The world had changed to accommodate him. Attitudes toward decision-making had shifted so dramatically since he was a kid that he'd been invited into professional basketball to speed the change. The availability of ever-cheaper computing power and the rise of data analysis obviously had a lot to do with making the world more hospitable to the approach Daryl Morey took to it. The change in the kind of person who got rich enough to buy a professional sports franchise also had helped. The owners often made their money from disrupting fields where most of the conventional wisdom is bullshit, said Maury. These people tended to be keenly aware of the value of even slight informational advantages and open to the idea of using data to gain those advantages. But this raised a bigger question. Why had so much conventional wisdom been bullshit? And not just in sports, but across the whole society. Why had so many industries been ripe for disruption? Why was there so much to be undone? It was curious when you thought about it that such a putatively competitive market as a market for highly paid athletes could be so inefficient in the first place. It was strange that when people bothered to measure what happened on the court, they had measured the wrong things so happily for so long. It was bizarre that it was even possible for a total outsider to walk into the game with an entirely new approach to valuing basketball players and see his approach adopted by much of the industry. At the bottom of the transformation in decision-making in professional sports, but not only in professional sports, were ideas about the human mind and how it functioned when it faced uncertain situations. These ideas had taken some time to seep into the culture, but now they were in the air we breathed. There was a new awareness of the sorts of systematic errors people might make, and so entire markets might make, if their judgments were left unchecked. There were reasons basketball experts could not see that Jeremy Lin was an NBA player, or could be blinded to the value of Marc Gasol by a single photograph of him, but would never see the next Shaquille O'Neal if he happened to be an Indian. It was like a fish not knowing he's breathing water unless someone points it out, Maury said, of people's awareness of their own mental processes. As it happens, someone had pointed it out. Chapter 2. The Outsider. Of Danny Kahneman's many doubts, the most curious were the ones he had about his own memory. He delivered entire semesters of lectures straight from his head without a note. To his students, he'd seemed to have memorized entire textbooks, and he wasn't shy about asking them to do it too. And yet, when he was asked about some event in his past, he'd say that he didn't trust his memory, and so you shouldn't either. Possibly this was a simple extension of what amounted to Danny's life strategy of not trusting himself.
His defining emotion is doubt, said one of his former students, and it's very useful because it makes him go deeper and deeper and deeper.
Or maybe he just wanted another line of defense against anyone hoping to figure him out. In any case, he kept at a great distance the forces and events that had shaped him.
He might not trust his memories, but he still had a few. For instance, he remembered the time in late 1941 or early 1942, at any rate a year or more after the start of the German occupation of Paris, when he was caught on the streets after curfew. The new laws required him to wear the yellow Star of David on the front of his sweater. His new badge caused him such deep shame that he took to going to school half an hour early so that the other children wouldn't see him walking into the building wearing it. After school, on the streets, he'd turn his sweater inside out. Heading home too late one evening, he saw a German soldier approaching. He was wearing the black uniform that I had been told to fear more than others, the one worn by specially recruited SS soldiers, he recalled, in the autobiographical statement required of him by the Nobel Committee. As I came closer to him, trying to walk fast, I noticed that he was looking at me intently. Then he beckoned me over, picked me up, and hugged me. I was terrified that he would notice the star inside my sweater. He was speaking to me with great emotion in German. When he put me down, he opened his wallet, showed me a picture of a boy, and gave me some money. I went home more certain than ever that my mother was right. People were endlessly complicated and interesting. He also remembered the sight of his father after he'd been taken away in a big sweep in November 1941. Thousands of Jews were rounded up and sent to camps. Danny had complicated feelings about his mother. His father he'd simply loved. My father was radiant. He had enormous charm. He was jailed in the makeshift prison in Drancy, outside of Paris. In Drancy, public housing designed for 700 people was used to imprison as many as 7,000 Jews at a time.
I have this memory of going with my mother to see this prison, Danny recalled, and I remember it was sort of pink-orange. There were people, but you couldn't see the faces. You could hear women and children, and I remember the prison guard. He said, "It's hard in there. They are eating peels." For most Jews, Drancy was just a stop on the way to a concentration camp. Upon arrival, many of the children were separated from their mothers and put on trains to be gassed at Auschwitz.
Danny's father was released after 6 weeks, thanks to his association with Eugene Schuller. Schuller was the founder and head of the giant French cosmetics company L'Oréal, where Danny's father worked as a chemist. Long after the war, Schuller would be exposed as one of the architects of an organization to help the Nazis find and kill French Jews. Somehow, he carved out in his mind a special exemption for his star chemist. He persuaded the Germans that Danny's father was central to the war effort, and he was sent back to Paris. Danny recalled that day vividly. We knew he was coming back, so we went shopping. When we came back, we rang the bell, and he opened the door, and he was wearing his best suit. He weighed 45 kilos, 99 pounds. He was skin and bones, and he hadn't eaten. That is the thing that impressed me. He waited for us to eat. Seeing that even Schuller couldn't keep them safe in Paris, Danny's father took his family and fled. By 1942, the borders were closed and there was no clear path to safety. Danny, his older sister Ruth, and his parents Ephraim and Rachel made a run for the south, which the Vichy regime still nominally governed. Along the way, there were close calls and complications. They hid in barns. Danny remembered those, along with the phony identity cards his father had somehow secured in Paris that contained a misspelling. Danny and his sister and mother were called Cadet, while his father had been given the name Godet. To avoid detection, Danny had been required to call his father Uncle. He also needed to do the speaking for his mother, as her first language was Yiddish, and she still spoke French with an accent. His mother, on mute, was a rare sight. She always had a great deal to say. She blamed her husband for their circumstances. They'd stayed in Paris only because he had allowed himself to be misguided by his memory of the Great War. The Germans hadn't gotten to Paris then, he'd said, so they surely wouldn't get to Paris now. She hadn't agreed. I do remember that my mother saw the horrors coming long before he did. She was the pessimist and the worrier. He was sunny and optimistic. Danny sensed already that he was very like his mother and not at all like his father. His feelings about himself were complicated. The approaching winter of 1942 found them in a coastal town called Juan-les-Pins in a state of dread.
They now had their own house, courtesy of the Nazi collaborator, with a chemistry lab in it so that Danny's father could continue to work. To blend into their new society, his parents sent Danny to school, with a warning to be careful not to say too much or seem too clever. They were afraid I would be identified as Jewish. For as long as he could remember, he had thought of himself as precocious and bookish. His body he felt little connection to. He was so bad at sports, he'd one day be referred to by classmates as the living corpse. A gym teacher would prevent him from being given academic honors on the grounds that there are limits to everything. His mind, however, was limber and muscular. From the moment he thought of what he might be when he grew up, he simply assumed he would be an intellectual. That was his image of himself, a brain without a body. He now had a new one, a rabbit in a rabbit hunt. The goal simply was to survive. On November 10, 1942, the Germans moved into the south of France. German soldiers in black uniforms now pulled men off buses and stripped them to see if they were circumcised. Anyone who was caught was dead, recalled Danny. His father firmly did not believe in God. His loss of faith had led him, as a young man, to leave Lithuania and the illustrious line of rabbis from which he descended for Paris. Danny wasn't ready to abandon the idea that the universe had some unseen caring force in it. I was sleeping under the same mosquito net as my parents, he said. They were in a big bed. I was in a small bed. I was 9, and I would pray to God. And the prayer was, I know you are very busy and that this is a tough time and all that. I don't want to ask for much, but I want to ask for one more day. Again, they fled for their lives, this time up the Côte d'Azur to Cagnes-sur-Mer, to a place owned by a colonel in the old French army. For the next few months, Danny was confined to quarters. He passed the time with books. He read and reread Around the World in 80 Days, and fell in love with all things English, and especially with Phileas Fogg. The French colonel had left behind a long shelf filled with accounts of the trench warfare at Verdun, and Danny read all of those, too, and became something of an expert on the subject. His father still worked in the house down the coast with the chemistry lab in it, traveling by bus to see his family on weekends. On Fridays, Danny sat with his mother in the garden and watched her darn socks and waited for his father to arrive. We lived on the hill and we could see the bus station. We never knew if he would come. I have hated waiting ever since. With help from the Vichy government and private bounty hunters, the Germans became more efficient at hunting Jews. Danny's father suffered from diabetes, but it was now more dangerous for him to seek treatment for it than to live with it untreated. Once again they ran, first to hotels and then, finally, to the chicken coop. The chicken coop was behind a country bar in a small village outside Limoges. Here there were no German soldiers, only the Milis, the paramilitary force collaborating with the Germans to help them round up Jews and exterminate the French resistance. How his father had found the place Danny didn't know, but L'Oréal's founder must have been involved, as the company continued to send packages of food. They erected a partition in the middle of the room so Danny's sister might have some privacy, but the coop wasn't really meant for anyone to live in. In winter it grew so cold the door froze shut. His sister tried to sleep on the stove and ended up with burn marks on her robe. To pass as Christians, Danny's mother and sister went to church on Sundays. Danny, now 10 years old, returned to school on the theory that he was less conspicuous there than hiding inside the chicken coop. The students at this new country school were even less able than the ones in Juan-les-Pins. The teacher was kind, but forgettable. The only lesson Danny recalled was the one about the facts of life. He found the details so preposterous that he was sure the teacher had been mistaken. I said, that is absolutely impossible. I asked my mother about it. She said it was so. Still, he didn't really believe it until one night when he was in bed with his mother sleeping beside him. Waking up and needing to use the outhouse, he climbed over her. She awakened to find her son on top of her. And my mother is terrified, and I think, it must be true after all. Even as a child, he had an almost theoretical interest in other people. Why they thought what they thought, why they behaved as they did. His direct experience of them was limited. He attended school but avoided social contact with his teachers and classmates. He had no friends. Even acquaintances were life-threatening. On the other hand, he witnessed from a certain distance a lot of interesting behavior. Both his teacher and the owners of the local bar, he had to believe, couldn't help but know that he was Jewish. Why else would this precocious 10-year-old city boy land in a schoolroom filled with country bumpkins? Why else would this clearly well-heeled family of four have piled into a chicken coop. Yet they gave him no sign they were anything but oblivious. His teacher gave him high marks, and even invited Danny to his home, and Madame Andreu, who owned the bar, asked him to help out, gave him tips for which he had no use, and even tried to talk to his mother into opening a brothel with her. A lot of other people quite obviously failed to see them for what they were. Danny remembered in particular the young French Nazi, a member of the Milis, who courted, without success, Danny's sister. She was now 19, with movie star looks. After the war, she took great pleasure in letting the Nazi know that he had fallen in love with a Jew. On the night of April 27, 1944, that date Danny remembered clearly, his father took him for a walk. He now had dark spots inside his mouth. 49 years old, he looked much older. He told me I might have to become responsible, recalled Danny. He told me to think of myself as the man of the family. He told me how to try to keep things under control with my mother, that I was sort of the sane one in the family. I had a book of poems I'd written, and I gave them to him, and he died that night. Of his father's death, Danny had little memory except that his mother had made him spend the night with Monsieur and Madame Andreu. There was another Jew hiding in their village. His mother had found him, and he had helped remove his father's body before Danny returned. She gave him a Jewish burial, but didn't invite Danny to attend, probably because it was so dangerous. "I was really angry about him dying," said Danny. "He had been good, but he had not been strong." The Allies invaded Normandy 6 weeks later. Danny never saw any soldiers. No American tanks rolled through his village with GIs on top tossing candy to children. One day he woke up and there was a feeling of joy in the air, and the Milis were being marched off to be shot or jailed, and a lot of women were walking around with shaved heads, punishment for having slept with a German. By December, the Germans had been driven out of France, and Danny and his mother were free to travel to Paris to see what remained of their home and chattels. Danny kept a notebook which he had titled, "What I Write of What I Think." I must have been intolerable. In Paris, he read, in one of his sister's school books, an essay by Pascal that inspired him to write in his notebook an essay of his own. The Germans were then launching their final counterattack to retake France, and Danny and his mother lived with the fear that they would break through. Danny wrote an essay that attempted to explain man's need for religion. He began with a quote from Pascal, "Faith is God made sensible to the heart," then added, "How true!" He followed this up with his own original line, "Cathedrals and organs are artificial ways of generating the same feeling." He no longer thought of God as an entity to which he might pray. Later, when he looked back on his life, he remembered his childhood pretensions and was both proud of and embarrassed by them. His precocious essay writing, he thought, was deeply linked in my mind with knowing that I was a Jew, with just a mind and no useful body, and that I would never fit in with other boys. In Paris, in their old pre-war apartment, Danny and his mother found only two battered green chairs. Still, they stayed. For the first time in 5 years, Danny attended school without having to disguise who he was. For years, he carried a fond memory of the friendship he struck up there with a pair of tall, handsome Russian aristocrats. The memory was so insistent, perhaps, because he had gone so long without friends. Much later in life, he tested his memory by tracking down the aristocratic Russian brothers and sending them a note. One brother had become an architect, the other a doctor. The brothers wrote back to say that they remembered him and sent him a picture of them all together. Danny wasn't in the picture. They must have been thinking he was somebody else. His lone friendship was imagined, not real. The Kahnemans no longer felt welcome in Europe and left in 1946. Danny's father's extended family had remained in Lithuania and, along with the 6,000 or so other Jews in their city, had been slaughtered. Only Danny's uncle, a rabbi who happened to be out of the country when the Germans rolled in, had been spared. He, like Danny's mother's family, now lived in Palestine, and so to Palestine they moved. Their arrival was sufficiently momentous that someone filmed it. The film was lost, but all Danny would later say he remembered of it was the glass of milk his uncle brought him. "I still remember how white it was," he said. "It was my first glass of milk in 5 years." Danny and his mother and sister moved in with his mother's family in Jerusalem. There, a year later, at the age of 13, Danny made his final decision about God. "I still remember where I was, the street in Jerusalem. I remember thinking that I could imagine there was a God, but not one who cared whether or not I masturbate. I reached the conclusion that there was no God. That was the end of my religious life. And that's pretty much what Danny Kahneman remembered, or chose to remember when asked about his childhood. From the age of 7, he'd been told to trust no one, and he'd obliged. His survival had depended on keeping himself apart and preventing others from seeing him for what he was. He was destined to become one of the world's most influential psychologists and a spectacularly original connoisseur of human error. His work would explore, among other things, the role of memory in human judgment. How, for instance, the French Army's memory of Germany's military strategy in the last war might lead them to misjudge that strategy in a new war. How a man's memory of German behavior in one war might lead him to misjudge Germans' intentions during the next. Or how the memory of a little boy back in Germany might prevent a member of Hitler's SS trained to spot Jews from seeing that the little boy he has picked up in his arms from the streets of Paris is a Jew. His own memories he didn't find all that relevant, however. For the rest of his life, he insisted that his past had little effect on his view of the world, or, ultimately, the world's view of him. "People say your childhood has a big influence on who you become," he'd say when pressed. "I'm not at all sure that's true." Even to those he came to regard as his friends, he never mentioned his Holocaust experience. Really, it wasn't until after he won the Nobel Prize and journalists started to badger him for the details of his life that he began to offer them up. His oldest friends would learn what had happened to him from the newspaper. The Kahnemans had arrived in Jerusalem just in time for another war. In the fall of 1947, the problem of Palestine passed from Britain to the United Nations, which, on November 29th, passed a resolution that formally divided the land into two states. The new Jewish state would be roughly the size of Connecticut, and the Arab state just a bit smaller than that. Jerusalem and its holy sites belonged to neither. Anyone living in Jerusalem would become a citizen of Jerusalem. In practice, there was an Arab Jerusalem and a Jewish Jerusalem, and the residents of each continued to do their best to kill each other. The apartment into which Danny moved with his mother was near the unofficial border. A bullet passed through Danny's bedroom. The leader of a scout troop was killed. And yet, Danny said, life didn't feel particularly dangerous. "It was so completely different because you are fighting. That is why it is better. I hated the status of being a Jew in Europe. I didn't want to be hunted. I didn't want to be a rabbit." Late one night in January 1948, he saw, with a palpable thrill, his first Jewish soldiers, 38 young fighters gathered in the basement of his building. Arab fighters had blockaded a cluster of Jewish settlements in the south of the tiny country. The 38 Jewish soldiers marched off from Danny's basement to rescue the settlers. Along the way, three turned back, one who had sprained an ankle, and two others to help him walk home, and so the group would become known for all time as the 35. They'd intended to march under cover of darkness, but the sun rose to find them still marching. They met an Arab shepherd and decided to let him go. At least, that is the story that Danny heard. The shepherd informed the Arab fighters, who ambushed and killed all 35 young men and then mutilated their bodies. Danny wondered at their disastrous decision. "Do you know why they were killed?" he said. "They were killed because they could not bring themselves to shoot a shepherd." A few months later, a convoy of doctors and nurses under the Red Cross banner drove the narrow road from the Jewish city to Mount Scopus, the site of Hebrew University and the hospital attached to it. Mount Scopus lay behind Arab lines, a Jewish island in a sea of Arabs. The only way in was through a mile-and-a-half-long narrow road over which the British guaranteed safe passage. Most of the time the trip was uneventful, but on this day a bomb exploded and stopped the lead vehicle, a Ford truck. Arab machine gun fire raked the buses and ambulances that followed. A few of the cars in the convoy were able to turn and speed off, but the buses, which carried passengers, were trapped. When the shooting stopped, 78 people were dead, their bodies so badly burned that they were buried in a mass grave. Among them was Enzo Bonaventura, a psychologist imported from Italy 9 years earlier by Hebrew University to build a department of psychology. His plans for a psychology department died with him. Whatever threat Danny felt to his existence, he declined to acknowledge. It looked very implausible that we would defeat 5 Arab nations, but somehow we were not worried. There really was no sense of impending doom that I could pick up. People were killed and so on, but for me, after World War II, it was a picnic. His mother evidently did not agree as she took her 14-year-old son and fled Jerusalem for Tel Aviv. On May 14, 1948, Israel declared itself a sovereign state, and the British soldiers left the next day. The armies of Jordan, Syria, and Egypt attacked, along with some troops from Iraq and Lebanon. For many months, Jerusalem was under siege, and life in Tel Aviv was far from normal. The minaret on the beach beside what is now the Intercontinental Hotel became an Arab sniper nest. The sniper could, and did, shoot at Jewish children on their way to and from school. "There were bullets flying everywhere," recalled Shimon Shamir, who was 14 years old and living in Tel Aviv when the war broke out, and would grow up to become the only person ever to serve as Israel's ambassador to both Egypt and Jordan. Shamir was Danny's first real friend. "The other kids in class felt there was some distance between them and him," said Shamir. "He wasn't looking for groups. He was very selective. He didn't need more than one friend." Danny spoke no Hebrew when he arrived in Israel the year before, but by the time he arrived at school in Tel Aviv, he spoke it fluently, and spoke English better than anyone else in the class. "He was considered brilliant," says Shamir. "I used to tease him, 'You're going to be famous,' and he would feel very uncomfortable about it. I hope I am not reading history back, but I think there was a feeling that he would go a long way." It was clear to all that Danny wasn't like the other boys. He wasn't trying to be unusual, he just was. "He was the only one in our class who tried to develop a proper English accent," said Shamir. "We all found that very funny. He was different in many ways. To some extent, he was an outsider, and it was because of his personality, not because he was a refugee." Even at the age of 14, Danny was less a boy than an intellectual trapped in a boy's body. "He was always absorbed in some problem or question," said Shamir. "I remember one day, he showed me a long essay he wrote for himself, which was strange because writing essays was a burden which you only did for school on the subject the teacher assigned. The whole idea of writing a very long essay on a subject that had nothing to do with the curriculum just because the subject interested him, that impressed me very much." He compared the personality of an English gentleman with that of a Greek aristocrat at the time of Heracles. Shamir felt that Danny was searching books in his own mind for a direction most children get from the people around them. "I think he was looking for an ideal," he said, "a role model." The War of Independence lasted for 10 months. A Jewish state that was the size of Connecticut before the war wound up a bit bigger than New Jersey. 1% of the Israeli population had been killed, the equivalent of 90,000 dead in New Jersey. 10,000 Arabs had died, and 750,000 Palestinians were displaced. After the war, Danny's mother moved them back to Jerusalem. There Danny made his second close friend, a boy of English descent named Ariel Ginsberg. Tel Aviv was poor, but Jerusalem was even poorer. Basically, no one owned a camera or a phone or even a doorbell. If you wanted to see a friend, you had to walk to his house and knock on the door or whistle. Danny would walk to Ariel's house, whistle, and Ariel would come down and they'd head to the YMCA to swim and play ping-pong without uttering a word. Danny thought that was just perfect. Ginsberg reminded him of Phileas Fogg. "Danny was different," says Ginsberg. "He felt apart, and he kept himself apart, up to a point. I was his only friend." In just a few years after the War of Independence, the Jewish population of what was now called Israel doubled, from 600,000 to 1.2 million. There can have been no time or place on earth where it was easier and more strongly encouraged for a Jewish person newly arrived in a country to assimilate into the local population. And yet, in spirit, Danny did not assimilate. The people to whom he gravitated were all native-born Israelis rather than fellow immigrants, but he himself did not seem Israeli. Like many Israeli boys and girls, he joined the Scouts, then quit when he and Ariel decided the group was not for them. Although he'd learned Hebrew with incredible speed, he and his mother spoke French at home, often in angry tones. "It was not a happy home," says Ginsberg. "His mother was a bitter woman. His sister got out of there as fast as she could." Danny didn't accept Israel's offer of a new prepackaged identity. He accepted its offer of a place to create his own. What that identity would be was hard to pin down, because Danny himself was so hard to pin down. He didn't seem to wish to settle anywhere in particular. What attachments he formed felt loose and provisional. Ruth Ginsberg, who was then dating and would soon marry Danny's close friend, said, "Danny decided very early on that he would not take responsibility. I had the feeling there was a need within him to always rationalize his unrootedness. a person who does not need roots. To have this view of life as a series of coincidences, it happened this way, but it could just as well have happened some other way, you make the best of it within these godless conditions. Danny's lack of need for a place or a group to belong to was especially glaring in a land of people hungry for a place and a people. I came in 1948, and I wanted to be like they are, recalls Yeshu Kolodny, a professor of geology at Hebrew University, Danny's age, whose extended family also had been wiped out in the Holocaust. Meaning I wanted to wear sandals and shorts rolled up and learn the name of every goddamn wadi, valley, or mountain. And mainly I wanted to lose my Russian accent. I was a little bit ashamed of my story. I came to worship the heroes of my people. Danny didn't feel that way. He looked down on this place. Danny was a refugee in the way that, say, Vladimir Nabokov was a refugee. A refugee who kept his distance. A refugee with airs. And a sharp eye for the locals. At the age of 15, he took a vocational test that identified him as a psychologist. It didn't surprise him. He'd always sensed that he would be some sort of professor, and the questions he had about human beings were more interesting to him than any others. My interest in psychology was a way to do philosophy, he said, to understand the world by understanding why people, especially me, see it as they do. By then, the question of whether God exists left me cold, but the question of why people believe God exists I found really fascinating. I was not really interested in right and wrong, but I was very interested in indignation. Now that's a psychologist. Most Israelis, upon finishing high school, were conscripted into the military. Identified as intellectually gifted, Danny was allowed to proceed directly to university to pursue a degree in psychology. How to do this was not obvious, as the country's only college campus lay behind Arab lines, and its plans for a psychology department had been killed in an Arab ambush. And so, on a morning in the fall of 1951, the 17-year-old Danny Kahneman sat in math class, held in a Jerusalem monastery that served as one of several temporary homes for Hebrew University. Even here, Danny seemed out of place. Most of the students had just come from serving 3 years in the army, and a lot of them had seen combat. Danny was younger and dressed in a jacket and tie, which struck the other students as preposterous. For the next 3 years, Danny essentially taught himself great swaths of his chosen field, as his teachers could not. My statistics teacher I loved, Danny recalled, but she didn't know statistics from beans. I taught myself statistics, from a book. His professors were less an assemblage of specialists than a collection of characters, most of them European refugees who happened to be willing to live in Israel. Basically, it was organized around charismatic teachers. People who had biographies, not just curriculum vitaes, recalled Avishai Margalit, who would go from Hebrew University to become a philosophy professor at Stanford, among other places. They had lived big lives. The most vivid was Yashayahu Leibowitz, whom Danny adored. Leibowitz had come to Palestine from Germany via Switzerland in the 1930s with advanced degrees in medicine, chemistry, the philosophy of science, and, it was rumored, a few other fields as well. Yet he tried and failed to get his driver's license 7 times. You'd see him walking the streets, recalled one former Leibowitz student, Maya Bar Hillel. His pants pulled up to his neck, he had these hunched shoulders and a Jay Leno chin. He'd be talking to himself and making these rhetorical gestures, but his mind attracted youth from all over the country. Whatever Leibowitz happened to be teaching, and there seemed no subject he could not teach, he never failed to put on a show. The course I took from him was called biochemistry, but it was basically about life, recalled another student. A large part of the class was devoted to explaining how stupid Ben-Gurion was. He was referring to David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister. One of Leibowitz's favorite stories was about a donkey placed equidistant from 2 bundles of hay. In the story, the donkey can't decide which bundle of hay is closer to him, and so dies of hunger. Leibowitz would then say that no donkey would do this. A donkey would just go at random to one or the other and eat. It's only when decisions are made by people that they get more complicated. And then he said, what happens to a country when a donkey makes the decisions that people are supposed to make, you can read every day in the paper. His class was always full. What Danny recalled of Leibowitz was typically peculiar. Not so much what the man had said, but the sound made by the chalk hitting the board when he wanted to make a point. It was like a gunshot. Even at that young age, And in those circumstances, it was possible to detect a drift in Danny's mind by the currents it resisted. Freud was in the air, but Danny didn't want anyone lying on his couch, and he really didn't want to lie upon anyone else's. He'd decided to attach no particular importance to his own childhood experience, or even his memories. Why should he care about other people's? By the early 1950s, some large number of the psychologists who insisted that the discipline be subject to the standards of science had given up the ambition to study the inner workings of the human mind. If you can't observe what is happening in the mind, how can you even pretend to make a study of it? What was deemed worthy of scientific attention and what could be studied scientifically was how living creatures behaved. The dominant school of thought was called behaviorism. Its king, B.F. Skinner, had gotten his start during the Second World War after the U.S. Air Force hired him to train pigeons to guide bombs. Skinner taught his pigeons to peck in the right spot on an aerial map of the target by rewarding them with food each time they did it. They did this with less enthusiasm when anti-aircraft fire was exploding around them, and so were never used in combat. Skinner's success with the pigeons was the start of a spectacularly influential career underpinned by the idea that all animal behavior was driven not by thoughts and feelings, but by external rewards and punishments. He locked rats inside what he called operant conditioning chambers. They soon became known as Skinner boxes, and taught them to pull levers and push buttons. He taught pigeons to dance and play ping-pong and bang out Take Me Out to the Ball Game on a piano. The behaviorists presumed that whatever they discovered about rats and pigeons applied to people, on whom, for various reasons, it was simply less practical to conduct experiments. To the reader who is anxious to advance to the human subject, a word of caution is an order, Skinner wrote, in an essay called How to Teach Animals. We must embark upon a program in which we sometimes apply relevant reinforcement and sometimes withhold it. In doing this, we are quite likely in humans to generate emotional effects. Unfortunately, the science of behavior is not yet as successful in controlling emotion as it is in shaping behavior. The allure of behaviorism was that the science appeared clean. The stimuli could be observed. The responses could be recorded. It seemed objective. It didn't rely on anyone telling anyone else what he thought or felt. All the important stuff was observable and measurable. There was a joke that captured the antiseptic spirit of behaviorism that Skinner himself liked to tell. A couple makes love. Afterward, one of them turns to the other and says, "It was good for you. How was it for me?" All the leading behaviorists were WASPs, a fact that didn't go unnoticed by young people entering psychology in the 1950s. Looking back, a casual observer of the field at that time couldn't help but wonder if there shouldn't be two entirely unrelated disciplines, WASP psychology and Jewish psychology. The WASPs marched around in white lab coats, carrying clipboards and thinking up new ways to torture rats, and all the while avoided the great wet mess of human experience. The Jews embraced the mess, even the Jews who disdained Freud's methods and longed for objectivity and wished to search for the kinds of truth that might be tested according to the rules of science. Danny, for his part, longed for objectivity. The school of psychological thought that most charmed him was Gestalt psychology. Led by German Jews, its origins were in early 20th century Berlin, it sought to explore scientifically the mysteries of the human mind. The Gestalt psychologists had made careers uncovering interesting phenomena and demonstrating them with great flair. A light appeared brighter when it emerged from total darkness. The color gray looked green when it was surrounded by violet, and yellow if surrounded by blue. If you said to a person, "Don't step on that banana eel," he'd be sure that you had said not eel, but peel. The Gestaltists showed that there was no obvious relationship between any external stimulus and the sensation it created in people, as the mind intervened in many curious ways. Danny was especially struck by the way that the Gestalt psychologists in their writings put their readers through an experience, so that they might feel for themselves the mysterious inner workings of their own minds. If on a clear night we look up at the sky, some stars are immediately seen as belonging together and as detached from their environment. The constellation Cassiopeia is an example. The Dipper is another. For ages, people have seen the same groups as units, and at the present time, children need no instruction in order to perceive the same units. Similarly, in Figure 1, please refer to the PDF that accompanies this program, the reader has before him two groups of patches. Why not merely six patches, or two other groups, or three groups of two members each? When looking casually at this pattern, everyone beholds the two groups of three patches each. The central question posed by Gestalt psychologists was the question the behaviorists had elected to ignore. How does the brain create meaning? How does it turn the fragments collected by the senses into a coherent picture of reality? Why does that picture so often seem to be imposed by the mind upon the world around it, rather than by the world upon the mind? How does a person turn the shards of memory into a coherent life story? Why does a person's understanding of what he sees change with the context in which he sees it? Why, to speak a bit loosely, when a regime bent on the destruction of the Jews rises to power in Europe, do some Jews see it for what it is and flee, and others stay to be slaughtered? These questions, or ones like them, had led Danny into psychology. They weren't the sort to be answered by even the most gifted rat. Their answers, if they existed, could be found only in the human mind. Later in his life, Danny would say that he thought of science as a conversation. If so, psychology was a noisy dinner party during which the guests talked past one another and changed the subject with bewildering frequency. The Gestalt psychologists and the behaviorists and the psychoanalysts might all be jammed into the same building with a plaque on the front that said Department of Psychology, but they didn't waste a lot of time listening to one another. Psychology wasn't like physics or even economics. It lacked a single persuasive theory to organize itself around, or even an agreed-upon set of rules for discussion. Its leading figures could, and did, say of the work of other psychologists, basically, what you're doing and saying is total bullshit, without any discernible effect on the behavior of those psychologists. Part of the problem was the wild diversity of the people who wanted to be psychologists, a rattlebag of characters with motives that range from the urge to rationalize their own unhappiness to a conviction that they had deep insights into human nature but lacked the literary power to write a decent novel, to a need for a market for their math skills after they'd been found inadequate by the physics department, to a simple desire to help people in pain. The other issue was the grandma's attic quality of the field. Psychology was a place all sorts of unrelated and seemingly unsolvable problems simply got tossed. It is possible to find two competent and highly productive academic psychologists who, if they had lunch together, would be forced to discuss the twins' chances for the pennant or Ronald the Red Killer's showmanship talents because they would have negligible overlap in their knowledge and interests in psychology, the University of Minnesota psychologist Paul Meal wrote in the famous 1986 essay, Psychology, does our heterogeneous subject matter have any unity? One can inquire as to why this is, whether anything can be done about it, or a question that should be asked first, does it really matter anyway? Why should a behavior geneticist studying the transmission of schizophrenia be able to converse with an expert on the electrochemical processes in the retina of the wall-eyed pike? Aptitude tests revealed Danny to be equally suited for the humanities and science, but he only wanted to do science. He also wanted to study people. Beyond that, it soon became clear he didn't know what he wanted to do. In his second year at Hebrew University, he listened to a talk by a visiting German neurosurgeon who claimed that damage to the brain caused people to lose the capacity for abstract thought. The claim turned out to be false, but Danny was so taken by it in that moment that he decided to chuck psychology to pursue a medical degree so that he'd be allowed to poke around the human brain and see what other effects he might generate. A professor eventually persuaded him that it was insane to go through the misery of acquiring a medical degree unless he actually wanted to be a doctor. But it was the start of a pattern, seizing on some idea or ambition with great enthusiasm only to abandon it in disappointment. "I've always felt ideas were a dime a dozen," he said. "If you had one that didn't work out, you should not fight too hard to save it. Just go find another." In an ordinary society, it is unlikely that anyone would ever have discovered the fantastic practical usefulness of Danny Kahneman. Israel wasn't a normal society. Graduating from Hebrew University, which somehow bestowed upon him a degree in psychology, Danny was required to serve in the Israeli army. Gentle, detached, disorganized, conflict-avoiding, and physically inept, Danny wasn't anyone's idea of a soldier. Only twice did he come close to having to fight, and both instances remained, to him, vividly memorable. The first time came when the platoon that he and several others commanded was ordered to attack an Arab village. Danny's platoon was meant to circle around the village and ambush any Arab forces. The year before, after an Israeli army unit had massacred Arab women and children, Danny and his friend Shimon Shamir had discussed what they would do if they were ordered to kill Arab civilians. They decided that they would refuse the order. Here was the closest Danny would come to being given that order. "We were not supposed to go into the village," he said. "The other officers were given their orders, and I listened, and they were never told to kill civilians, but they were never told how not to kill civilians. And I couldn't ask the question because it wasn't my mission." In the event, his own mission was aborted and his unit withdrawn before it came anywhere near to shooting at anyone, and only later did he learn why. The other platoons had walked into an ambush. The Jordanian army had been waiting for them. "Had he not withdrawn, we would have been butchered." The other time, he was sent one night to lay ambushes for the Jordanian army. He had three squads in his platoon. He led each of the first two squads to their ambush sites and left subordinates in charge of them. The third, on the Jordanian border, he led himself. To find the border, his commanding officer, a poet named Chaim Guri, told him he should walk until he reached a sign, "Frontier, stop." In the dark, Danny missed the sign. As the sun rose, what he saw instead was an enemy soldier on a hill with his back to him. He'd invaded Jordan. "I nearly started a war." The stretch of land beneath the hill in front of them, he saw, was ideally suited for Jordanian snipers looking to pick off Israeli soldiers. Danny turned to sneak his patrol back into Israel, but then he noticed that one of his men was missing his pack. Imagining the dressing down he'd receive for leaving a pack in Jordan, he and his men crept around the fringes of the kill zone. "It was incredibly dangerous. I knew how stupid it was, but we would stay until we found it, because I could hear the first question, 'How could you leave that pack?' That has stayed with me, the idiocy of it." They found the pack, then left. Upon his return, his superiors admonished him, but not about the backpack. They said, "Why didn't you shoot?" The army jolted him out of his usual self-assigned role of detached observer. His year as a platoon commander, Danny said later, removed the remaining traces of the pervasive sense of vulnerability and physical weakness and incompetence which I had had in France. But he wasn't born to shoot at people. He wasn't really suited to army life either, but the army forced him to be suitable. They assigned him to the psychology unit. The chief feature of the Israeli Army psychology unit in 1954 was that it had no psychologists. Upon joining it, Danny found that his new boss, the Israeli Army's chief of psychological research, was a chemist. So Danny, a 20-year-old refugee from Europe, who had spent a meaningful amount of his life in hiding, found himself the Israel Defense Forces expert on psychological matters. "He was thin, ugly, and very clever," recalls Tammy Viz, who served with Danny in the psychology unit. "I was 19, and he was 21, and I think he flirted with me, and I was so dumb I didn't know it. He was not a normal guy, but people liked him." They also needed him, though how much they surely did not immediately appreciate. The new nation faced a serious problem. How to organize a madly diverse population into a fighting force. In 1948, David Ben-Gurion had declared Israel open to any Jew who wished to immigrate. Over the next 5 years, the state accepted more than 730,000 immigrants from different cultures, speaking different languages. Many of the young men entering the new Israel Defense Forces already had endured unspeakable horrors. Everywhere you turned, you found people with numbers tattooed on their arms. Mothers stumbled unexpectedly upon their own children, who they thought had been murdered by the Germans, on the streets of Israeli cities. No one was encouraged to speak about what he'd experienced in war. People who had post-traumatic stress disorder were considered weaklings, as one Israeli psychologist put it. Part of the job of being an Israeli Jew was to at least pretend to forget the unforgettable. Israel was still less a nation than a fort. And yet its army was in a state of barely controlled chaos. The soldiers were poorly trained, the units poorly coordinated. The head of the tank division didn't even speak the same language as most of his men. In the early 1950s, there was no formal war between Arabs and Jews, but the senseless metronomic violence exposed vulnerabilities in the Israeli military. The soldiers tended to cut and run at the first sign of trouble, for instance, and the officers tended to lead from behind. The infantry staged a succession of failed night raids on Arab outposts, during which Israeli troops got lost in the dark and never reached their targets. In one case, after a unit sent out to stage an attack spent the night wandering around in circles, the platoon commander had simply shot himself. When they managed to engage the enemy, the results were often disastrous. In October 1953, an Israeli unit that may or may not have been given instructions not to harm civilians had raided a Jordanian village and killed 69 people, half of them women and children. Since the First World War, the job of assessing and sorting young conscripts into armies had fallen to psychologists, mainly because some ambitious psychologists had talked the U.S. Army into giving them the job. Still, if you need to sort tens of thousands of young men quickly into an efficient fighting force, it's not immediately obvious that you also need a psychologist, and even less obvious when the only psychologist at hand is a 21-year-old graduate of a 2-year program who has more or less taught himself. Danny himself was surprised they asked him to do it and did not feel equipped for the job, and he'd already seen the difficulty of trying to figure out which person was suited to which job when his superiors had asked him to evaluate candidates for officer training school. The young men applying to become officers had been given a weirdly artificial task, to move themselves from one side of a wall to the other without touching the wall, using only a long log that was not permitted to touch either the wall or the ground. We noted who took charge, who tried to lead and was rebuffed, how cooperative each soldier was in contributing to the group effort, Danny wrote. We saw who seemed to be stubborn, submissive, arrogant, patient, hot-tempered, persistent, or a quitter. We saw competitive spite when someone whose idea had been rejected by the group sabotaged its efforts. And we saw reactions to crisis. Under the stress of the event, we felt each man's true nature was revealed. The impression we had of each candidate's character was as direct and compelling as the color of the sky. He had had no trouble identifying which men would make good officers and which would not. We were quite willing to declare, this one will never make it, that fellow is rather mediocre, or he will be a star. The problem came when he tested his predictions against the outcomes, how the various candidates had actually performed in officer training. His predictions were worthless. And yet because it was the Army, and he had a job to do, he kept on making them, and because he was Danny, he noted that he still felt confident about them. The situation reminded him of the famous Mueller-Lyer optical illusion. See Figure 2 in the PDF. Presented with two lines of equal length, the eye is tricked into seeing one as being longer than the other. Even after you prove to people with a ruler that the lines are identical, the illusion persists. They'll insist that one line still looks longer than the other. If perception had the power to overwhelm reality in such a simple case, how much power might it have in a more complicated one? Danny's commanding officers believed that each branch of the Israel Defense Forces had its own personality. There was a fighter pilot type, and an armored unit type, and an infantry soldier type, and so on. They wanted Danny to determine for which branch any particular recruit was best suited. Danny set out to create a personality test that would effectively sort the entire population of Israel into the correct buckets. He began by listing the handful of traits he thought most obviously correlated with a man's fitness for combat service: masculine pride, punctuality, sociability, sense of duty, capacity for independent thought. The list of traits was not derived from anything, he later said. I just thought it up. A professional would take years to do it, using pretests, trying out multiple versions, etc., but I didn't know it was difficult to do. The hard part, Danny thought, was getting an accurate measure of any of these traits from an ordinary job interview. The subtle difficulties that arise when people evaluate other people had been described back in 1915 by an American psychologist named Edward Thorndike. Thorndike asked U.S. Army officers to rate their men according to some physical trait, physique, for example, and then assess some less tangible quality, intelligence, leadership, and so forth. He discovered that the feeling created by making the first ranking bled into the second. If an officer thought a soldier physically impressive, he also found him impressive in other ways. Switch the order of assessment, and the same problem occurred. If a person was first judged to be generally great, he was then judged to be stronger than he actually was. Obviously, a halo of general merit is extended to influence the rating for the special ability, or vice versa, Thorndike concluded. He went on to say that he had become convinced that even a very capable foreman, employer, teacher, or department head is unable to view an individual as a compound of separate qualities and to assign a magnitude to each of these in independence of the others. Thus was born what is still called the halo effect. Danny knew of the halo effect, and he could see that the Israeli army interviewers had been its victims. They had been spending 20 minutes with each new recruit, and from the encounter offering a general impression of the recruit's character. General impressions had been proven to be misleading, and so Danny wanted to avoid them. For that matter, he wanted to avoid having to rely on human judgment. Exactly why he mistrusted human judgment, he was unsure. In retrospect, he suspected he must have read a recent book by Paul Meehl, the same Meehl who wondered what, if anything, unified the field of psychology. Meehl's book, called Clinical versus Statistical Prediction, had shown that psychoanalysts who tried to predict what would become of their neurotic patients fared poorly compared to simple algorithms. Published in 1954, just a year before Danny overhauled the Israeli army's assessment of the country's youth, it had angered psychoanalysts, who believed that their clinical judgments and predictions had great value. It also raised a more general question. If these putative experts could be misled about the value of their predictions, who would not be misled? "All I know is that I must have read Meehl because of what I did," said Danny. What he did was teach the army interviewers, young women mainly, how to put a list of questions to each recruit to minimize the halo effect. He told them to pose very specific questions, designed to determine not how a person thought of himself, but how the person had actually behaved. The questions were not just fact-seeking, but designed to disguise the facts being sought, and at the end of each section, before moving on to the next, the interviewer was to assign a rating from 1 to 5 that corresponded with choices ranging from never displays this kind of behavior to always displays this kind of behavior. So, for example, when evaluating a recruit's sociability, they'd give a 5 to a person who forms close social relationships and identifies completely with the whole group, and a 1 to a person who is completely isolated. Even Danny could see that there were all kinds of problems with his methods, but he didn't have the time to worry too much about them. For instance, he briefly agonized over how to define a 3. Was it someone who was extremely sociable on occasion, or someone who was moderately sociable all the time? Both, he basically decided. The big thing was that the judge was to keep her private opinions to herself. The question was not, what do I think of him, but what has he done? The judgment of who went where in the Israeli army was to be made by Danny's algorithm. The interviewers hated it, he recalled. I had a mutiny on my hands. I still remember one of them saying, "You're turning us into robots." They had a sense that they could tell a person's character, and I was robbing them of that. And they really didn't like it. Danny then had himself driven by an assistant around the country so that he could ask army officers to assign character trait ratings to their own soldiers, which he could then compare to the soldier's performance. Find the characteristics of the people who are good in a particular branch of the military, his thinking went, and you could use them to identify others who shared those traits and should be assigned to that branch. His memory of his trip was typically unusual, preserving a curious detail rather than the broad picture. He didn't recall much about his encounters with combat officers, but he remembered vividly what the driver had said after Danny had taken the wheel of the Jeep. Danny had never before driven. After he braked in anticipation of a bump in the road, the driver praised him. He said, "That is exactly the right gentleness." From the combat officers in the field, Danny learned that he'd been sent on a fool's errand. The military stereotypes were false. There were no meaningful differences between the personalities of successful people in the different branches. The personality that succeeded in the infantry was more or less the same as the personality that succeeded beside an artillery piece or inside a tank. The scores on Danny's personality test did predict something, however. They predicted the likelihood the recruit would succeed in any job. They gave the Israeli army a better idea than it had before of who would succeed as an officer or as a member of some elite service, fighter pilot, paratrooper, and who would not. They also turned out to predict who would end up in jail. Maybe, more surprisingly, the results were only loosely correlated with intelligence and education, which is to say, they contained information that those simple measures did not. The effect of what became known informally as the Kahneman score was to make better military use of an entire nation and, in particular, to reduce, in the selection of its military leaders, the importance of raw, measurable intelligence and increase the importance of the qualities on Danny's list. The process Danny created proved to be so successful that the Israeli military has used it right up to the present day with only minor adjustments. When women were admitted to combat units, for instance, masculine pride became pride. They tried to really change it once, said Reuven Gaul, the author of A Portrait of the Israeli Soldier. Gaul served for 5 years as chief psychologist of the Israel Defense Forces. They made it worse, so they changed it back. Upon leaving the army in 1983, Gaul went to Washington, D.C.